You are listening to station WGN.
Oh, a microphony!
And a phony at the mic! Yeah. Whoa!
And radio became an accepted vehicle for nationwide news and opinion.
Notify all radio and TV stations to broadcast the following message.
Oh, is that the comedy spot?
No, Bubblehead, this isn't a comedy spot.
You're a fun guy, Dave. You're lonely on an island.
What a dope. What a maroon.
Quiet, please. In exactly 15 seconds, we'll be on the air.
This is exciting, isn't it?
10, 5, 4, 3, 2.
And now, live from the Allstate Skyline Studios, here's Dave.
And welcome in, everybody. It's Dave Plyer here on 720 WGN. Glad you could be with us on this Saturday night, early Sunday morning. Now, tonight it's a tribute to 70s TV. The most popular shows of the decade's first half, such as All in the Family, MASH, and Good Times, took on social issues with directness and passion. But by the late 70s, the biggest hits, Happy Days, Laverne and Shirley, Charlie's Angels, and The Love Boat, were all about nostalgia and escapism. And in honor of this iconic era in television, tonight we bring you my conversations with some of the stars that led the way. Alan Alda of MASH, Cheryl Ladd of Charlie's Angels, Cindy Williams from Laverne and Shirley, Suzanne Summers of Three's Company, and Gavin McLeod from both The Mary Tyler Moore Show and The Love Boat. Plus, in our history segment tonight, Dave Schwann gets his kicks down Route 66, starting right here in Illinois. We'll talk about why it's still important and how it represents a changing America. But first, change that dial back to the 1970s with a conversation with the legendary Alan Alda of MASH.
Ever get the feeling there's a war going on?
There's always a war going on. War is the world's favorite spectator sport. Who needs more skin sutures?
Well, everybody knows war is hell. Remember, you heard it here last.
War isn't hell. War is war and hell is hell. And of the two, war is a lot worse.
How do you figure that, Hawkeye?
Easy, Father. Tell me, who goes to hell?
Sinners, I believe.
Exactly. There are no innocent bystanders in hell. But war is chock full of them. Little kids, cripples, old ladies. In fact, except for a few of the brass, almost everybody involved is an innocent bystander.
Well, I'm not. I'm here because my country needs me.
I didn't know it wasn't just some excuse to ship you 8,000 miles from home.
Yeah, the Korean War was invented so your parents wouldn't come looking for you.
You're a pair of sickos.
Science was something that was always in your DNA. Your father wanted you to be a doctor, not play one on TV, but become a doctor. But you weren't that great in chemistry.
Well, I didn't want to be great in chemistry, and I wanted to fail the course because I didn't want to be a doctor. I wanted to be a writer and an actor. But it turned out it wasn't that hard to fail the course. I actually excelled at failing.
That's fantastic. How did your interest in science and reading scientific studies begin, Alan?
It must have begun in my childhood because I was always interested in how things were the way they were. How did things get that way? And why are you saying that to that other person? Like, I think that's the beginning of an interest in science, and it only increased as time went on.
And you've had inspiration through science throughout your entire life. But with this new book, it wasn't a doctor visit, but it was a dental visit that inspired this new mission to write your new book.
Well, it was certainly a pivotal moment in my life. The dentist was taking out a front tooth that should have come out decades earlier. And he had some new operation he had invented that was going to pull some of my gum over the socket of the left by the tooth. It was going to give me a great blood supply for healing. And that all sounded fine.
Yeah.
Then when he had the scalpel right in front of my face before he started to do the operation, he said, "Now there'll be some tethering." And I said, "There'll be what?" He said, "Tethering, tethering, tethering." He started yelling at me. I didn't know what he was talking about. He never explained it. I never did get an explanation. And it altered my smile. I was making a movie a couple of weeks later, and I smiled, and it came out like a sneer.
Mm.
But so that's all right, because I've been able to play villains a lot better now.
So, but with that, you know, he said he kind of loudly barked at you a little bit.
It was really a vivid example of how somebody who's in a position to really communicate something important to you but something that he knows all about, but you don't know anything about. It's his responsibility to make sure you get it.
Sure.
That's like the essence of the whole process of communicating something to somebody. It doesn't matter how precise you are or how perfect your message is. If it doesn't reach the other person and get in their head and stick with them, you might have saved yourself the time of perfecting your message, because the message is only as good as it works.
Well, in this book, and although you're focused very much on scientists communicating better, the book is an amazing tool for all people in their respective careers and beyond to understand the critical importance of connecting to one another.
Yeah, you know, I think the same thing applies if a mother is trying to talk her daughter off a dangerous drug, or a couple is trying to figure out, and it's funny, I talk in the book about how there's one study that I find it hard to believe that the study is real, that one of the things couples fight the most about is how to load the dishwasher. But it doesn't seem like a strange thing to fight about, but whether or not that's one of the major fights, we all get into disagreements and rub each other the wrong way about trivial things very often. And that makes up the substance of our lives. And yet we could have smoother sailing through all of those waters if we were able to read what was going on in the other person's head. It just calms everything down. As I've been teaching this and working on it with all the people who teach all the people we teach, I've been paying more attention to it. I've been getting more empathy, more understanding of how other people are feeling. Not being sympathetic to it, but just understanding what they're going through. I find people are much less annoying now.
Well, that's good. That's a benefit there. As I was going to say, my wife did give me hell for a long time on how I loaded the dishwasher. Now what she does is when I'm done loading it, I'll walk away and then she'll open it back up and just do it herself.
I read that's a common solution.
Yeah, exactly.
But isn't that a strange thing that we pick something like that? I wonder if it's territorial. You know, I run the kitchen. Whichever sex it is, saying that, or yeah. I know how to stack things. Sure. Something about that. My identity is tied up in stacking.
Yeah, right.
It doesn't seem like
you're totally right. Oh no, you're totally right. And I know you know this. You know, in the age of social media and texting and Facebook and Snapchatting, we have really, as a society, let go of that face to face interaction, that voice to voice human conversation. It's missing right now in our society.
I think you're right, and I also think that we're somewhere in us aware of that and struggling with the problem, because I think all of us have had the experience of writing a text message or an email message and thinking somewhere in that message, as we tap it out, we think, how is that going to sound? Do they think I'm being snarky with them? I'm just saying, I'm not really being snarky.
Right.
And that's when we put an emoji in or a smiley face. And that's an indication to me that there's still some vestigial interest in how the other person is feeling.
Sure.
And if we hang on to that and build on it, we might be able to communicate even better, actually talk in real words, perhaps.
Well, and you're right about that. And the thing to me is sometimes texting and not that human interaction where you see somebody can be misconstrued as well as being hostile or being mean or trying to be funny when you weren't trying to be funny. It's really hard, even though there's emojis and so forth to do that, it's very hard to really connect to that person in a way you're trying to communicate to them in that way. And I think that's where the problem lies.
It is, and I've found that what really helps is the same thing that helps when you're communicating face-to-face and not with your fingers on a keypad. And what it is that helps is being aware all the time as you're communicating to the other person, what are they going through as I tell them this? Because an awful lot of the time we think about what we want to say, and we don't think about how it's being received. That's like the main problem with communication. And I know a psychologist who's doing research on that very thing to try to pinpoint the way we can, the way we misfire when we do that and how we can do better.
So you did some radio when you were at Fordham. You were in the ROTC. You did a lot of stage work, nominated for a Tony. You did a lot of early film and television work in Sergeant Bilko in The Twilight Zone and Paper Lion, nominated for a Golden Globe. And you really did a lot more drama than comedy. And then you auditioned for MASH. So, you know, what intrigued you about this role?
Well, it's funny you say that, because if they saw me, I never auditioned for MASH. My work was sort of known from stage and movies, and they just asked me to do it. But it's interesting you say mostly I had done serious parts. So if they got the idea from seeing that I could do MASH, that's an interesting idea.
Yeah.
I had done comedies on Broadway, so I think they knew me from that. I did the Owl and the Pussycat, Diana, sure, the stage version of it before the movie came out. But what intrigued me about it was that it was written so well. The pilot was written by Larry Gelbart, who was a comedy genius, and it was some of the best writing for television I had ever seen. I was a little worried that it might become a trivial, that it might present war in a trivial way. And I waited until the last minute. I was making a movie in a prison in Utah,
right,
when I got the script. So I had to wait till I got out of prison to agree to do the show MASH and to have a conversation with them where we decided that we all agreed that we were going to take the war seriously, that we would, it wouldn't just be off stage. We'd see the results of it.
Which would be, of course.
It didn't bother the audience at all.
I mean, no.
That became the hallmarks of the show.
Yeah, I love that you want to do that. I mean, you didn't want it to be all laughs. It could be some jokes. It could be some laughs. But you really wanted that reality. And that probably best sets it up for what war was all about. I mean, there was moments that I would laugh out loud, and then there was moments that I would really take pause to listen to what you were saying and put myself where you were.
Yeah, thank you. I think that's one of the benefits of watching good drama. And I really, my own personal taste is that I'd like to see a play that shows me the laughter in life, and also acknowledges that eventually we're all going to die. Not literally, but that life isn't all laughing, and you laugh anyway.
Sure.
Isn't the laugh sweeter if you laugh anyway than if you just laugh and ignore the fact that there are things not to laugh at?
Well, you bring up a play. I always felt that MASH was a 22-minute play that aired every week, and even though maybe the earlier seasons were a little more comedy than drama, and then maybe the later seasons were a little more drama than comedy, I always felt like I was watching kind of a self-contained play every week. It just seemed like what you were doing on stage.
I don't know why some people have made that distinction, because some of the most serious stuff occurred early in the show's run.
Yeah.
I remember in the first or second year, a patient died on the operating table in a show written by Larry Gelbart, who was a comic genius, I thought. But he had this patient die on the table, and it was a patient, a close friend of Hawkeye's. So there was a big emotional response to it. And that was part of the beginnings of MASH. The network was really worried about getting so deep into the parts of war that really hurt, like death and dismemberment and that kind of thing, which is hard to take. But the head of the network said, "What is this? A situation tragedy?"
Is that right?
But it didn't. The audience didn't mind. I think they took it all in all as, for how we meant it, which was to try to reflect the lives of the people who really lived through that experience.
Well, that's what put that human connection in there is, when Henry Blake,
what you described before of watching a human experience.
I mean, when Henry Blake, you know, died, and I know that was a script that was, you know, you knew about it, but it was a script that was kind of handed to everyone at the last minute, and it was a real reaction, not only from the people on stage, but, you know, I remember it still is that being one of the most poignant moments on television that really set the tone. Where here's this really funny guy. We've been laughing at the show for the first 3 years here. It's fabulous, but this is the reality of war.
Yeah, and I think Larry Gelbart, who wrote that scene, felt that it could help you understand what it's like when you're talking to your buddy 1 minute, and a minute later, the buddy is gone.
Right.
And the shock of that, the surprise, I think the whole audience felt to it, come to know the characters. The other element in it was a little more human. Larry Gelbart, who wrote the scene, was upset with McLean Stevenson, who played the character who died, and he was upset with him for leaving the show. So he wrote a scene that made it so he could never come back.
Right. Yeah. I mean,
it wasn't all art.
No, not at all. Not at all. And I think what brought that cast together so well in tying that time of your life back to the book, you would sit around and do table reads, but there was a bonding. You told stories about each other's lives. Before you even started reading the scripts, you had deep relationships with these people that ultimately helped you communicate better when the camera was on.
Yeah, and we did that all through the run of the series. We sat in chairs between shots instead of retreating to our dressing rooms. Most of the time we sat together and just laughed.
Yeah.
And that really, that a lot of people talked about the rapport the cast had.
Oh, yeah.
They seemed like they had been living together for those months. And I think that's what did it, is that we really did have a connection that we kept going. We in some ways, we deliberately knew that we were helping the show by that connection we were maintaining.
Here's what I noticed when I've seen some MASH bloopers on the air. A lot of television shows, you know, you can get them on the DVDs and so forth, or they're on YouTube or wherever. And it was always fun and games. Someone messed up, they'd go back, whatever. You and the cast seemed really frustrated when you would flub, because it kind of broke that continuity of what you were trying to communicate. Like, it wasn't as other comedies, it would just be laughing off and it would be 10, 15 minutes before they get started again. You guys got right back into it.
Well, yes, except for those times when we get into a laughing jag because it's late in the afternoon and the lights have sucked all the oxygen out of the air and you're just helpless. Somebody makes some stupid mistake, and then you try to go on, and you can't. They could last 15 or 20 minutes.
Yeah.
And very often, a fellow actor would be directing the show. The day before, when he wasn't directing, he'd be helpless with laughter during the laughing jag period. Now that he's director, he's not laughing. He's saying, come on, people.
Yeah, right. Well, that was you,
whoever
too.
Whoever was in charge really suffered.
Yeah, yeah.
The legendary Alan Alda. More on our 70s TV flashback with Cheryl Ladd of Charlie's Angels after the news next on 720 WGN. So the original Charlie's Angels that debuted in 1976 defined a generation. 110 episodes over 5 seasons that starred Farrah Fawcett, Jacqueline Smith, Kate Jackson, Shelley Hack, Tanya Roberts, and our guest tonight, Cheryl Ladd.
Once upon a time, there were 3 little girls who went to the police academy. 2 in Los Angeles. The other in San Francisco. And they were each assigned very hazardous duties. But I took them away from all that, and now they work for me. My name is Charlie.
Dave, nice talking to you.
You know, I know I confessed right before we got on the air here that I still had my Cheryl Ladd album.
I love that. That's so great.
Wasn't it a blue silk something you were wearing on the front of this album cover?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, a little base, like a baseball jacket.
That's right. That's right. That's right. Did you think that we'd still be talking about this iconic 70s series 40 years later? Isn't that crazy?
Isn't it crazy? No, it never really occurred to me. I thought it would be like, you know, just another, you know, show that was pretty successful and made some noise. I had no idea. I still have such amazing fans that are so loyal, and it's still being shown around the world. And you know, three women walk into an office and somebody says, well, who do you think you are, Charlie's Angels? It's such an iconic image that, you know, the whole idea of it. It's amazing that it's part of the vocabulary of the world now.
When you think about when that show started, I mean, we really had the three networks and some random independent stations, and the number of people that would sit down and watch a show together and talk about it that next morning was unbelievable. I mean, something that's a time gone by.
I know. It was a family show. Everybody could watch it and enjoy it all for different reasons.
That's true. Yeah, that's very true. Now, you grew up in rural South Dakota, not a place you would think would inspire someone to enter the entertainment industry, but you knew pretty early on that you wanted to be on stage and you wanted to do this for a living.
I did. I was pretty convinced that's where my joy button was. That's where my spirit felt comfortable and my desire to express myself. I was such a strange child. I was a sort of a tomboy, but I was also, you know, really had an amazing imagination. I wouldn't just play dress-ups and be the princess. I would be, you know, I'd have my dollies next to me and a scarf tied around my neck, and I'm driving my covered wagon and, you know, trying to save my children from the tornado, and, you know,
yeah,
it was so crazy.
But, you know, you say being a tomboy, my wife's a little bit of a tomboy herself, and what I see in that is somebody who is aggressive and they go after what they want. That's kind of what I see in all of that.
Yeah, pretty determined.
Yeah.
Yes. I was never a girly girl.
Yeah.
My grandmothers and my mother and my older sister and lots of aunts. And I kind of hung out with my uncles and my grandpa and my dad, and I liked the guys. I just, you know, yeah, I just felt more comfortable in that circumstance.
Now, you really hit the stage first, you know, taking dancing lessons, and you performed in high school plays, you sang in the choir, and you were even part of a folk trio. I mean, a lot of people might not know this, but you really were a singer before you were an actress.
That's right. Singing was my ticket out of South Dakota.
Yeah.
I left after I had the folk group in high school. Then I joined a jazz band and traveled around the country, and that's how I ended up in Los Angeles.
Yeah, that's pretty crazy. So you're, you know, before your senior year in high school, so, you know, just finished
that's
your junior
right.
year, and you were asked to audition.
I had to give up cheerleading.
Yeah, oh my gosh. And that's the big thing, of course, in high school. But, you know, to be a lead singer of a local jazz band, it was called The Music Shop. How did that all come about?
Well, you know, it's just one of those things that the universe arranges for you. You know, God said, okay, here's a little, your first step. So they had a wonderful singer. She became ill. She, I guess, recovered from it, but she was so ill she couldn't travel, and they had all of these bookings already, and they didn't want to give up the opportunity to play some, and they got some, I guess, some places that they had been working hard to get into. So they said, oh, we have to find a singer. We don't want to lose this opportunity to play in these places. So I was working, you know, in South Dakota. I was doing absolutely every single thing I could to perform, whether it was singing at the women's clubs or doing dance recitals and performing, any kind of performance thing that I was in it. And one of the guys that ran the radio station said, you know, You're really talented. How would you like to come and, you know, try out doing some commercials on the radio? Because I do all the commercials here, and everybody's so used to hearing my voice, I think they just tune me out. Would you like to come and try to do some commercials? I said, sure. So I did some voiceover stuff and commercials and things like that. And he said, you know, a friend of mine, you sing. I've heard you sing. My friend of mine has a band, and they're looking for a new singer. Would you like to audition for them? I said, yes.
Yeah, at such a young age. Yeah.
You know, I was very young. I was 16. I lied and told him I was 18, and he said, no, I don't think so. I said, 17? And he goes, I'm not sure about that either.
<That's>
but
cool.
I was just about to turn 17 in that summer. So.
And you were
anyway,
Sherry?
That's when I started singing, and I had to give up cheerleading, which was, I don't think here in South Dakota has gotten over it yet, because in a little town like that, you know, being a cheerleader is a very...
It's a big deal.
very big honor, you know?
Yeah.
It's what every girl aspires to.
And you were singing, you were Sherry Moore, which was your name on stage.
That's right.
And you were touring around and a little more full time, and you were in LA for a performance date. And that's when you just ended up staying there. I mean, that's you kind of said, you know what? I'm not going home. I'm staying right here.
Well, I was so fortunate because the people that were booking us in all of these nightclubs, there's a wonderful story. They were called Art and Edna Whiting, and they had a booking agency and booked clubs and performers and, you know, musicians and you know, magic acts and things like that all through the Midwest. And they were an old vaudeville couple, and they performed in vaudeville. And eventually, when vaudeville was dying, they decided to become booking agents. And they had been doing it for many years. They discovered Miyoshi Umeki and Jimmy Rogers. I mean, names that, you know, young mm-hmm. people wouldn't recognize, mm-hmm. but, you know, people that had careers. I mean, Miyoshi Umeki was in Flower Drum Song, I believe. Anyway, nominated for an Academy Award.
Mm-hmm.
So, when they saw me singing with a band on it, they said, if you guys ever end up in L.A. and you want to stay, we'll help you. You can stay here in our house with us till you get on your feet. We really believe in you, and we think you're great, and bless their hearts.
Yeah, that's great, too, being so young and being able to stay with somebody, feel safe, you know, while you're exploring and doing all
and,
that.
You know, and I pitched in, and their son, who was also part of the company, and his wife, Carol, who we became great friends, and they had two little boys, so I babysit or I, you know, do dishes or whatever I could to pitch in while I was there. And I got one of the first jobs I went on was this singing voice for Melody and Josie and the Pussycats.
I know.
So as soon as I got that job, I got to get an apartment and a car, and I was on my way.
That was pretty cool. And, you know, that was the height of Saturday morning cartoons and looking for great talent to do all of that. And then you guys started getting some dramatic roles, too. 72, you got a role on a crime drama called The Rookies, which was produced by Aaron Spelling and Leonard Goldberg, which obviously turned out to be a much longer relationship there. You did The Partridge.
That was the mustard seed, one. Yeah.
Yeah, uh-huh. I planted that.
That's right.
You did The Partridge Family, the second season of Happy Days. You played a movie starlet, and I remember this well because I don't think I saw it when it was originally on, but I saw maybe a rerun of it in the late 70s, and I said, gosh, she looks like the girl from Charlie's Angels. And then I think the name in the credits was your maiden name, Cheryl Stoppelmore. And I said, nah, that's not her. That must not be her. That's somebody else. Forget about it.
But, yes, my name was Stoppelmore, and that's the name I used when I was first starting out. Mm-hmm.
And then you did.
And then I married David Ladd, and then we were married for 7 years, and I became famous during that time, and I was Cheryl Ladd, so
absolutely.
It was a lot easier for people to pronounce and spell, and it was bigger on the marquee.
I bet it was. But you did a lot of these. You did Police Story, you did Police Woman, you did Streets of San Francisco, well on your way, and in 75, there was a pilot called The Alley Cats, which was the concept of these three crime-fighting women that would reside in alleys and wear whips and chains, which I think you would have gotten a whole other audience for that show. that's crazy. And I just read about that was kind of the original concept.
And then Kate came up with Angel.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah, a little more family-friendly.
Aaron had a painting in his office, and it had three angels in it. She said, what about angels?
Yeah.
How about?
Smart.
He said, yeah, like Charlie's Angels.
And that was it. Yeah, it was Kate Jackson. It was Jacqueline Smith.
Yeah.
It was Farrah Fawcett, along with the classic voice of John Forsythe, David Doyle. Wednesdays at 9 on ABC Central here. And huge hit, rose to number 5 in its time slot. Farrah wanted out, and the opportunity came in the second season. And did Aaron and Leonard remember you from 5-6 years earlier?
Absolutely. I had worked for them. You know, when they were doing Family, I don't know if you remember that show.
Yeah, Chrissy McNichol.
It came down to Meredith Baxter, Bernie, and myself for the role of the daughter in that show. And you know, the two of us read like four times for the network. They just could not make up their mind, and then they eventually went with her. I was devastated.
Yeah.
And then Aaron called me when Farrah left and said he wanted me to do Charlie's Angels, and I said no.
Yeah, you didn't want it originally. So what made you think, you know, I don't want to step in? Was it because Farrah was so big in the show?
It was a combination of I didn't really get the show. I mean, I had never actually seen the show, but, you know, mm-hmm. I was reading about it, and it was not getting, you know, much respect at the time,
yeah.
And shall I say. And I was just about to get a role in one of the best TV shows ever, you know, at the time, one that was really looked at as the real deal. And mm-hmm. so you can imagine how upset I was. And anyway, so I said no, and Aaron went, he said, okay, and moved on. And I guess they looked at some couple hundred women, and Aaron eventually called me and said, Cheryl, will you just come in and talk to me about this? I said, of course I will. And he wanted to know why I didn't want to do it. And I said, well, first of all, it's kind of crazy to try to replace Farrah. I mean, I don't know how that's going to happen because, you know, at that time she was the biggest thing since sliced bread.
It was, but it was only one season. You know, I mean, technically, yeah. Really, it was just one season, and I know it was a big
that's
hit,
right.
but still, big shoes to fill.
Then I said, well, I don't know what to play. He said, what do you mean? I said, I don't know. Who would I be? I'm an actor. I have to have something that makes sense to me to play. And he said, well, like, what do you mean? I said, well, I don't know if my character could be funny. He said, why can't she be funny? I said, oh. And if she was like the real rookie and when she was coming in and a little insecure and just trying really hard and could make mistakes, he said, I like that. We could do that. I go, really? And he said, yeah. And he said, and what if, I've got it. What if you're, this is Aaron's genius. What if you're Jill's little sister
yeah.
and your family?
Yeah.
And then I knew there was something for me to play.
Yeah. A little bit more welcoming from a fan perspective who watched that first season that, you know, you were part of the family coming into the set. The issue was you really, you know, I saw Aaron, an interview of Aaron's that said, you know, when Cheryl came on the show, we really got like no nasty fan letters that we replaced with. Because I think a lot of people knew publicly that Farrah wanted off the show. So it wasn't
yeah.
somebody's fault. It wasn't, you know, you didn't come in and, you know, they didn't just cast you to replace her, so to speak. She wanted off. And so it was very welcoming. It was a little less welcoming in the beginning on the set, though.
Well, you know, I think everybody was nervous. They had the hit TV show.
Yeah.
The great news was everything got a lot warmer when we became number one because I was on the show.
Yeah, right? I mean, so...
Everything warmed up a little bit right
yeah.
then there.
Yeah, well, I was going to say, so there you have
it. Everybody was just nervous. They didn't know what to expect. They
sure.
didn't know if their show was going to be on another season. And, you know, that's a really scary place to be for people who know they have a hit show or had a hit show and weren't sure if it was all going to work. The great part was that, you know, David Doyle knew how nervous I was. I mean, I walked on the set with a T-shirt that said Farrah Fawcett Minor. I mean, I was not trying. I just wanted to make friends. I just wanted everybody
yeah.
to
yeah.
kind of take a deep breath and give me a chance. And that's what happened. David Doyle put his arm around me after the first couple of scenes that we did together, and he said, okay, just relax. You're great. You're great. It's going to be great. It's going to be great. He was so sweet. And
that's
yeah,
awesome.
And so it just got better and better.
And, you know, you were so big at the time. Stardom came so fast. Did you handle that well, did you feel?
No, I think it was so much, and everybody's saying, oh, you got to strike while the iron's hot. So while I was on Charlie's Angels, I was doing in hiatus movies, the television, recording record albums. I had a two-year-old daughter. I was just taking on way too much. No, I don't think I think
it was a lot at the time. It was a lot.
It was a lot. And I just, you know, I think it just put such stress on the marriage and on our, and we were young, you know, you forget,
yeah.
but we were in our 20s.
Of course.
I look back at it now and I don't even know how I survived it, really.
Oh, right. Yeah. Yeah. And 5 years later, the show still such a big hit, still being seen across the country today, 40 years old. Love seeing you. You've been out there ever since Charlie's Angels has ended on TV, movies, and Broadway, and music, and your own series, and that we've seen you on NCIS, CSI, Ray Donovan. We can get the newly released Charlie's Angels complete series on DVD, and for more on Cheryl, you can visit CherylLadd.com. How cool it has been to hang out with you and talk about your career in this classic series. I really appreciate you taking the time, Cheryl.
Thank you, Dave. Such a pleasure for me, too.
All right.
God bless.
Thanks. Same to you. All right. Much more ahead on 720 WGN.
All right. Laverne. This is Laverne DeFazio. She's mine. And this is Shirley Feeney. She's yours, as you can see.
Nice to meet you, Richie.
My pleasure.
Hey, they're getting along pretty well, huh? Hey, plant it here, girls. Plant it here.
I'm trying to sit down.
Staring? How'd you like your eyes closed for good, huh?
You're too much, Laverne.
So, Cheryl, what do you think of this kid? You've been with worse.
Oh, he's nice. And a tie, too.
And a hanky. Is that for showing or for blowing?
Well, it's been quite an evening. What do you say we go to Richie's house?
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. Schlemiel. Schlemazel. Hasenbemp Incorporated.
All right, nostalgia ruled the airwaves in the 1970s with Happy Days and Laverne and Shirley. And by its third season, Laverne and Shirley was the most watched show on television. It starred the late Penny Marshall and Cindy Williams, who began her flashback to the 1950s in the 1973 coming-of-age film American Graffiti. And to share her story, Cindy Williams joins us tonight.
Hey, Dave, even I'm impressed.
That's awesome. Well, you've had such a long, great career, man. I mean, you've had a lot of fun.
Yeah, I've had fun, and I have been so blessed.
You were getting guest roles on various television shows, and not long after that, American Graffiti came along. And I know when you auditioned for a different role. How did that all come about?
I wanted to play Debbie, the bad girl that Candy Clark played, but it had already been cast with Candy, so they couldn't, you know, cast this ingenue. So I said, oh, come on. You know, all she does is weep and whine all night. And they said, we can't find anyone. You have to audition for it. And so I said, okay, because they were friends. You know, Fred Roos was my friend, and he started me out in show business. So I said, okay. And I went over, and I auditioned with Ron Howard. Ronnie. He was Ronnie then.
Right.
Ronnie Howard. And he was just lovely. And I had just gotten... You know, I had literally just gotten off the plane from Spain, where I had shot Travels with My Aunt, and I was jet lagging. So I told Ronnie, I said, I'm going to have to hold the script. And he said, that's okay. And he, pardon me, I've got the hiccups.
He was so
sweet, Ron Howard. And he said, that's okay, you can hold the script. And so I did, and we did our screen test and left, and then they offered me the role. And the rest is show business history.
Yeah, I mean, not bad for a first big film, you know, produced by Francis Ford Coppola, who just came off The Godfather, writer-director George Lucas. I know, you know, I've read it wasn't a really easy movie to make because it first started as a project for United Artists, then it made its way to Universal. The film ended up, you know, with a small budget. It was like a little over $1 million, and it grossed.
No, it wasn't. It was $775,000, and most of that went to the rights, to pay off the rights for the music.
Oh, God.
In the movie.
Can you imagine that?
So, Harrison Ford, and I know Harry doesn't mind me saying this, he was paid $400 a week. And Richard and Ronnie and I were paid the most. We were paid $1,000 a week for 4 weeks. That was it.
Wow. But it grossed like $55 million eventually. I mean, this thing was nominated for an Oscar, won Best Picture at the Golden Globes. I mean, this is one of those movies that you put on the shelf and say, this is an iconic piece of Americana.
Yes, it is. And it's on the AFI 100 top best movies of all time list, and we had no idea. We thought we were doing a hot rod movie, and then 2 weeks into it, which was half of the production, we were George invited us invited us into the editing bay to watch a 20-minute assemblage of the film with music. And when that was over, we picked our jaws up off the ground, and we all knew we were in something majestic.
Was that the role that said to you in everything you did so far, like, wow, this is the role that really said, I'm on my way? I mean, this is it. This was the trajectory for me.
You know, I wouldn't say it was the role, but I'd say it was the film. And because,
okay,
you know, that wasn't my thing, playing. Although up till then, I'd never gotten to play comedy, which I wanted to play so badly. And I was always the lead's best friend. I was always the ingenue's best friend. And then in American Graffiti, I was the actual ingenue. But where everybody else got to have fun and hijinks, I just wept all night, you know. And but that was the job. And I was certainly in the movie that changed everything around for me.
Yeah. No, absolutely. Absolutely it did. And then, you know, I was reading right before Laverne and Shirley, you and Penny were writing a movie together. Is that right? So did you meet writing this movie, or was it before then that you got to know each other?
No, we had met before then on a double date, oddly enough.
Really?
And, yeah, that's in the book about when we went to the Coconut Grove, and that's where we met, and that's where Little Richard blessed us, and and we always, you know, gave him the thumbs up for the success of Laverne and Shirley for that blessing. And because we went to the Coconut Grove to see Liza Minnelli, or we were taken there by our dates to see Liza Minnelli, and opening for her was Little Richard. And there's a whole thing in the book about that. But yeah, we were writing, and then after that, we were writing partners on this film for Francis Coppola, who was producing this bicentennial spoof, and there were teams of writers. My Country Tis of Thee.
Yeah,
that's right. Yeah. It never got made.
Yeah.
It was very funny. Carr Gottlieb was the producer on that, and Steve Martin, Martin Mull, Harry Shearer, just fabulous writers were writing on it, and they had asked me and Penny to team up. Don't ask, and write. And that was the first time we really worked together. And, you know, we had the same sensibility, this kind of cartoon minds. You know, we had these cartoon, we saw things in cartoon terms, and we wrote very funny sketches for that movie.
Tuesday night, November 11th, 1975, you debuted as Shirley on this episode of Happy Days. How did that all come along? Was it Gary that engaged Penny, or how did that all go?
Well, that's while we were writing. We got a phone call, and it was Gary, and he asked Penny, he said, I got these two parts on Happy Days, these two girls who date the fleet.
I love your Gary impersonation.
yeah, and I thought maybe you and Cindy could come over, take a week off, come over, play the parts. And Penny said, yeah, here's Cindy. And she put me on the phone, and he said, you know, that to me. And I said, yeah, sounds like fun if Carl will let us go. And Carl let us go. And we went over and played these two girls. Oh, my goodness. We had no idea. Neither one of us had ever seen Happy Day. She hadn't seen it. And I didn't have a TV and at the time. And so we just played these girls coming on. We were smoking real cigarettes when we came on.
Is
in
that
rehearsal.
Right?
Oh, yeah. Fixing each other's lingerie, pulling up each other's bra straps and doing all this stuff. And the director.
I just remember it was pretty damn
Gary
sexy
Perry.
For that show to have yeah,
well,
I mean, you played a pretty
well,
cool
role.
Well,
we had no idea. We were on like a family. We didn't even know what a family show meant.
Just,
and we flicked our cigarettes across the stage and came on. And then Jerry Paris, who was directing, said,
right.
Stop. And he said, you can't smoke. This is family hour. You can't smoke. Go off stage and begin again. And we had no idea what the heck he was talking about.
Just 35 million.
Family Hour? What was he talking about?
Family hour and 35 million people watching the show.
And we just had no idea what he was talking about. So we put the cigarettes out, and we were chewing gum. We said, all right, we'll chew gum, and we'll have bobby pins in our hair, and we'll cut the checking each other's bra straps out, and we'll just come on, whatever. And so we did, and we did the show, and we went back to our little writing job. And then about, I don't know, 2-3 weeks later, somebody called and said, they want to do a spinoff. Again, we had no idea what that meant. And it had to be explained to us what a spinoff was. And, and then it went on from there.
Yeah, but that happened so quickly. I mean, it was literally, it aired in November.
Very fast.
And you were on the air in January. And by the way, the week you premiered, it was number one. The show was number one the week it premiered. I mean, it became, a few years later, you were the number one show on television, but it was the most watched show for the premiere. That's crazy. Oop, did I lose you?
You know, Penny and I, it was like, I don't know, taking two, waitresses and saying, you're famous. Saying what? I'm telling you, it took us a year to catch up with and get and say, oh, we get it.
Yeah.
We had no idea. We were so naive. And, I mean, someone asked me just today, they asked me about the accent on the show. I said, it was so fast and everything. And then it started, and every cast member was from back east, and they all have these, Eastern accents.
Right, yeah.
And so I thought, well, I better have one too. And I didn't even have time to process that or think about it. And so I just adopted this sort of, kind of bad, very bad New York accent.
It was thicker in the beginning of the show. Yeah,
it was terrible, terrible. It was awful, and I knew it. But I thought, well, everybody else has it. But we're from Milwaukee.
Yeah, right.
What the heck? And I thought, well, Milwaukee, maybe they have, those accents. Anyway, 13 weeks into it, Gary came down onto the stage, and I write about that in the book, and he said, Cindy, I want to talk to you about the accent. I said, lose it? He said, yes. I said, thank you. And that was the end of that. Penny and I had no time to process this. None. It's like being taken from, oblivion into like the Kleeglites. I can't even describe it to anybody. It's like, it's just, just daunting. Daunting.
Yeah.
And then about a year later, it caught up with us, or we caught up with it, and said, so this is what it's like. And we were famous. And it's just like, oh my God. And people ask me, what's it like to be famous? It's like everything you think it is. It's just like overwhelming, fabulous, thrilling, daunting, a little frightening, and wonderful.
Do you remember the first public appearance you made outside of the studio? What that was like? Because I've talked to Henry Winkler about the days of Happy Days and walking off a plane and seeing these people, and he was wondering who those people were here to see. Was the president landing here? What was the crowds for? I mean, right?
Well, the first time we realized we were really popular, we were asked to do the Macy's Day Thanksgiving Day Parade. And so we were on this float, and we're coming down Fifth Avenue. It's Fifth Avenue, right?
Mm-hmm.
And
Macy's
started pushing.
Yeah, Macy's would have been Broadway. And yeah. But anyway, go ahead.
Wherever it was. And we're up on the float waving, and this crowd starts, and they break the barriers, they push the barriers down, and they start running toward us, and Penny and I look behind us to see who they were running toward. And we thought it was the Rolling Stones or somebody, and it was us.
That's awesome.
And then the police came and stopped the crowd, and that was the first time that I think either one of us realized the popularity of the show.
But the characters were so great. It was such a fun show. You know, the upbeat, always smiling, cute Shirley Feeney and the tough, sarcastic Laverne DeFazio on this program. And at the time, and I just remember people talking about this because there were real water cooler moments at the time. There was no social media. The social media was talking about what you saw the next day at school, the next day at work. And people compared you to like a modern day Lucy and Ethel. They were talking about Lucille Ball and Vivian Vance, that you were the next incarnation of this great comedy duo. That's pretty cool.
That is. It's just beyond, you know, honoring and thrilling. It's just unbelievable. But, you know, Penny and I, we never thought about that. What we thought of was what made us laugh. And what we thought of in rehearsal was, because some of the script, you know, I mean, some of the shows weren't great, and there were some that were, I'd put them up there with wonderful, wonderful comedy shows. But we would, in rehearsal, if it didn't make us laugh out loud, then we knew it wasn't going to make the audience laugh out loud. So our goal each week between us was, and the whole cast, was to make ourselves laugh out loud, because we knew that would translate to the studio audience and then again to the television audience and make everybody laugh out loud. That's what we tried to do.
Well, you challenged the writers. You challenged the writers to make it a better show.
We did. We challenged Well, what we do is, because we were writers ourselves, we would improvise. Mm-hmm. You know, during rehearsal, and we would change things around. We got ourselves into trouble because of that. And, you know, and looking back on it, we did not give the writers their due respect. We didn't, because we were so just hell-bent to do our own thing, make sure that it was funny as we could make it. We'd throw things out, and people would get their feelings hurt. And, you know, Penny and I, we realize it now, but we didn't realize it back then, that we were hurting people's feelings. And there had to be, you know, but that being said, everybody did pull together, and the writers would come down and see what we made of their themes, you know, what we made right. of their writing. And
ultimately,
a mutual admiration society.
Well, I was going to say, ultimately, you made a better product together. Really?
We did. Yeah. All of us.
Yeah.
Writers, producers, everybody included. Because all of us, including the writers, wanted to make that audience laugh out loud.
You were surrounded by great people on in front of the camera, too. Michael McKean, David Lander, Eddie Mecca, Phil Foster, Betty Garrett. I mean, it was just such a fun group.
Oh, my goodness. The entire cast, you know, I hope I said that before. It wasn't just me and Penny. It was the entire cast that was in sync. In fact, one time I said, you know, if this cast was an Olympic team, if they had Olympic teams for comedy, we'd medal. We'd at least take the bronze. I remember saying that to Penny one night, and it was about the whole cast. I mean, we were just always in sync, all of us, no matter what was going on backstage, no matter if Penny and I were arguing about something or anything, we hit that stage and all of us were in sync.
I bet you it was tough, too. I've seen some of the DVD collections and the blooper reels and stuff. It was probably hard to keep a straight face in some of the stuff because, as you said, you wanted to make it so funny while you're on the air. It must have been hard not to break character.
Well, it was, but you know what, Dave? We didn't have too many bloopers because we had laughed it out during rehearsal. There were a few. And there was one in particular that we never stopped laughing. It's in the show. We don't stop laughing. We can't stop laughing at ourselves.
That's great.
And
love it.
It's in the dating show where we get wet because we run out and there, a fire hydrant has exploded or something, and the fire department's there. And we've just gotten ready for dates, and we run out because the boys say something to us, Lenny and Squiggy, and we run outside, and we get totally soaked, and we come in, and Penny and I just, and you know, we saved everything for the show. We, in other words, we didn't run it, like, with the water, with the wetness, until the actual show.
Right.
And so that one, we could not bite our cheeks enough to keep ourselves from laughing.
That's
and
awesome.
So you see it. You see it there.
You know, do you have some favorite episodes that you say, gosh, those are my favorite? That's got to be one of them, obviously.
I got a couple. I've got Murder on the Moose Jaw Express, which is a two-parter, and Guinea Pigs, which is where we want to go to this cocktail party at the Hotel Pfister to meet professional men. And so we volunteer at Lenny and Squiggy's personal little gold mine, which is a experimental laboratory, you know, and people volunteer to go in and they get $20 each. And we needed the $20 to get into this cocktail party, so we volunteer. And that's one of my one of my favorite shows. And then
I would say for me, it was one of the early ones was the one where you were going to a high society party and Henry Winkler was a guest.
That's the premiere show.
Is that the first show?
Oh,
my God. Honestly, that's a classic. That is just a absolute classic because it really established the characters.
Where we get our dresses from Squiggy's uncle's wax museum.
Yes, exactly.
He brings us
it just sounds silly,
off of the models at the wax museum, and we go to this party, this high society party.
Yeah.
And, that was the first show. And let's see. There's like 13, I'd say there's 13 or 14 shows that are my favorite. And Penny and I have like four of them that cross over that are both
That's
of
cool.
our favorite shows.
That's cool. Cindy, what an inspirational story, and what a pleasure it has been hanging out with you tonight.
You too, Dave. Thank you so much.
All right, it's Dave Player on 720 WGN, and welcome back to our 70s TV flashback. So Suzanne Somers was at the height of her career, winning accolades and the public's admiration for playing blonde Chrissy Snow on ABC's hit Emmy-winning comedy Three's Company, alongside John Ritter and Joyce DeWitt. And to talk about life on the sexy 70s sitcom, here is Suzanne Somers.
Wait a minute. You mean you'd undress in front of strangers but not in front of moi?
Right.
That doesn't make any sense.
Of course it does. If they see me nude, it doesn't matter because I don't know them and they don't know me and I don't know who's seeing me and they don't know who they're seeing. But I know you and you know me and I know who you'll be seeing and you know who you'll be seeing and both of them are me. See?
No, I don't see.
And you're not going to.
Well, it's nice to have you with us, Suzanne. We're throwing it back to the 1970s tonight. Three's Company aired its final episode 35 years ago this year. How did you get the role?
I got a call from ABC for a show called Three's Company, and they're really interested in you. So I went in really not caring, and I think that's how you get a part.
I think you're right.
I wasn't desperate. I wasn't trying to please. I was just like, this is my last interview, and it was almost like, what a relief. And now I can kind of focus my life on something that I actually could pull off. I could pull off teaching cooking. And so I read. They said, thank you very much. I drive home, and the phone rings. And it's this kind of an agent who wasn't really, no papers, nothing. She said, oh, my God, you got the part. And I said,
wow.
I was so over. I said, what part? She said, Three's Company. And
wow.
I couldn't believe it. Again, this surreal thing happened. And I walked onto the set that first day with John Ritter and Joyce DeWitt, who are both so highly trained, feeling inadequate, and I told them all, I said, I just have to tell you, I have a supreme interest in this craft, but it was cut short by life events, and I will do everything I can to pull this off and learn. And there was one producer of Nichols, Ross & West, Mickey Ross, who was an old vaudevillian, and he took me under his wing, kind of like Henry Higgins took Eliza Doolittle under his wing.
Yep.
And he worked with me in the way that, remember Nadia Comaneci and her coach?
And her coach, yeah. How, yep, yeah.
Remember, and remember Nadia do a flip on the board, and she first thing she'd do, not listen to the audience, she'd look over
to
at
her coach.
Her coach.
Absolutely.
And he'd either give her a thumbs up or a thumbs down. Well, that's how
that's relationship.
Mickey Ross worked with me. I would do a scene, and when I finished, I looked right at him, and he'd call me over, and he'd either give me a thumbs up or a thumbs down, and he taught me to hear the music of comedy. And I remember one day, if you watch the episodes, it's fun that these are all going to be out. The year one, I was hanging on by my claws, and I think I succeeded because it was so raw. It was so unpolished. It was so naive, and I was so naive. I even looked different. I never had my hair or makeup done professionally.
Right. Yeah.
By year two, professional people had started taking over my hair and makeup, and my look was changing, and I met this one hairdresser, Bjorn, who was always stoned, and he said to me one day, "Baby."
And probably very creative, by the way.
Very creative. And he said, "I think Chrissy Snow should have snow white hair and big pink cheeks and dark eyes." And I said, "Do it." So he made my hair snow white, and that's when the character really took off, because I looked in the mirror, and I looked like Chrissy Snow. And so one day, in kind of three-quarters of the way through the second season, I'm watching John Ritter, and it hit me. Oh, comedy is musical. It's set up, set up, beat. I'm musical. I always got the leads in all the musicals. I get music. And that was when it took off. I got it. I was able to give her a moral code, what she would and wouldn't do, in a way that the audience would anticipate her, because they knew what she would and wouldn't do. It's delicious to do a character when the audience laughs before you do it.
Right, right. Just the anticipation, exactly. Yeah.
Exactly. So.
Well, did the producers allow you to develop the character, or did they completely control what was happening in front of the camera, or did you have a piece of that?
Well, after a while, the chemistry and the dance between John Ritter and myself, Jack and Chrissy, became so enormous that what we rehearsed in the rehearsal room was there. But they had isolated cameras on both of us, and because it was tape and not film, you didn't have to be so specific as to hit your mark. On tape, the whole set is lit. If you're doing a film series, you can't ad-lib because it's only lit for that X that's on the floor. I find film very limiting in that way. And so when the audience would laugh at something we didn't anticipate in rehearsal, Jack and Chrissy would keep on going. And those were those delicious moments that couldn't be written. They were just incredible.
Initially, my folks would not let me watch the show. That first season, they finally warmed up because I think they realized it was probably less about the sexual references and double entendres and more the fun, simple slapstick humor that really kind of took over the show. And in the first 4 years, even though the critics weren't fond of the show was consistently in the top 10. Three of the four seasons that you were on, or the first four seasons, it was number two for the first 2 years, number three. It was really the golden age of the series when you were on.
And at a time that will never happen again. Only three choices. There was ABC, NBC, and CBS.
Right,
and everybody was watching ABC because of that Tuesday night lineup with
Happy Days,
Shirley, Three's Company, and Happy Days.
Right.
It was really quite a powerhouse night. It's funny that it was considered risque in light of what what's on TV today.
Oh, yeah.
It was non-sexual. I mean, nothing was ever going on
right
in that house. Chrissy Snow was finally kissed, I think, in the last season. And that was that scene where Jack and Janet, who really were the parents, were pacing and where is she and where is she? I knew we shouldn't have let her go out. If you really analyze it, if I was the child and they were the parents.
Right.
And Jack opens the door, and there I am, with my arms around my date's neck, his arms around my waist, and my feet were in the air, bowed out, one going one direction, one going the other, the way you would expect Chrissy Snow would get kissed for the first time.
Yeah.
The most non-sexual kiss ever on television. So it was really, there was something very safe about this series. I don't know why the critics at that time didn't want to like Three's Company. There's something about it that irritated the press. We never got good press.
Yeah.
And Chrissy Snow never got good press. And in looking back, I think Chrissy Snow was a delicious character. I think Jack Tripper was a delicious character. And last year I was lying in bed one Saturday night watching Saturday Night Live, and on comes Lady Gaga, Justin Timberlake, and I don't know who the third person was.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, Lady Gaga was playing Chrissy Snow, and Justin Timberlake was Jack, and they were doing this mock-up of, if it's three-way, then it ain't gay. And they did this whole song and dance thing, and I looked at my husband, and I said, amazing that they fired me, and here, all these years later, the character is still iconic.
Oh, of course.
Maybe by getting fired, it left the country wanting more. That's all I've ever heard of. Oh, I miss you on that show. Oh, why aren't you doing that show anymore? So,
Was the thing. That was the thing. Yeah. After four successful seasons, you know, the fourth season came along. The show was rated number two, handful of points from number one. You were looking for an increase in salary, and which would put you on par with most of the male actors in a top ten show. The Fonz became the breakout star on Happy Days. J.J. Walker became the breakout star on Good Times. And although it was truly an ensemble, you, John, and Joyce, producers felt John was the star of the show and that Ray's was never going to come. And was it because it was a time in history where it was more of a male-dominated business that was running it and they didn't recognize the contribution?
Absolutely. And I don't say this as a female victim. I've never been a victim. But my contract was up. I had every right to renegotiate.
Yeah.
When I went in and said, the men in television on lesser shows than mine are making 10 and 15 times more than I am.
Yeah.
And I have the highest demographics of any woman on television at that time. They wanted to make an example so that no other woman in television at that time would get uppity and ask for parity. And I'd gotten a call, an inside call from someone at ABC very high up, and they said to my husband, they said, look, they're going to hang a nun in the marketplace, and it's going to be Suzanne. So just know that going in. And I thought, why would they want to get rid of Chrissy Snow?
Yeah.
Why would they want to do that? That's like getting rid of Edith.
Yeah.
With Archie Bunker. I mean,
well, yeah, even
Archie
as a
Bunker
viewer,
great, but he needed Edith to play off of, and same thing. And I think the reason that John never talked to me again was he was so angry at losing his great sparring partner.
Yeah, that's a shame. Because I was going to say, the relationships didn't get maintained after that happened. It still was a top 20 show, but it wasn't the same. It wasn't number one, number two, number five.
Right.
It dropped quite a bit. And it's a shame that it broke some of the personal relationships.
Oh, terrible.
You had going on, too.
It's an interesting story. This Mickey Ross, who took me under his wing, I believe, this is my belief, that in that process he fell in love with me in the way that a father would desire his daughter but knows it's wrong. And so there was never any overtures. But when I married Alan Hamill, his demeanor towards me changed so much. And when the day of the negotiation came,
mm-hmm.
When my contract was up, it was my husband, who was then my manager, who went in to ABC, the lawyer's office. His name was George Sunderland, and Mickey Ross was sitting there. And my husband always describes the scene. He walks in, and Mickey Ross is a chain smoker, and he smokes with his thumb and his first finger, one of those kind of smokers.
Mm-hmm.
And he's sitting there smoking that kind of violently. And my husband says, as you realize, Suzanne has you know, brought enormous visibility to the show, and she's got the highest demographics of any woman in television. Every year, she's on a minimum of 40 to 50 national magazine covers. She's been featured in the new Barbara Walters and had her own specials and everything, and yet the men are making 10 to 15 times more, so she would like you to pay what she's paying some of the men. And Mickey Ross took his cigarette and threw it on the floor of the ABC lawyer's office and stomped it out on the floor and comes over to my husband and leans over him and says, "You want me to share my blood with her?" And my husband leaned forward and said, "Yes." And he said, "She's fired." And that was
wow. Wow.
And then fired was one thing, but they forced me to work off
your contract.
Yeah. So that's when they relegated me to 1 minute at the end of the show, a phone call from my sick aunt's house calling Jack and Janet, who I never saw again or talked to. I was just talking to a dead telephone.
It's amazing.
And would say, "Oh, I miss you so much, but she's still so sick, and I don't know when I'll be back." And that went on for the rest of the season. When they show the episodes, they never show those 1 minute because they're pathetic. And sometimes when I think about it, it was so crazy because they would have a guard meet me out at the back door. We were taping at CBS, even though it was an ABC show. Walk me into a cordoned-off corridor. I wasn't allowed to interact or see anybody else in the show.
That's
like
so
a prisoner.
Horrible. Yeah.
I'd go in. My hair and makeup person would do my beauty stuff, and then I'd be taken out to this poorly lit little corner set away from the other set. I didn't see one person from the crew, a chair, a lamp, and a telephone, and I'd do my minute and then go home. And I would leave crying every week because it was so wrong. It
yeah.
was so wrong. So it was, I think after that, there were, I remember at one of the NAPP or whatever the convention is where they sell syndicated
yep.
shows, I think it's NAPP. One of the executives got up and said, the loss in syndication fees with the firing of Suzanne Summers is in the untold millions and maybe more, because the shows without the Chrissy Snow character just don't get the same revenue as the other ones.
I bet.
So I think after that, the next one who asked for money was Roseanne, and they gave it to her. No problem. She got $750,000 mm-hmm. a week. And people go, $750,000? Well, if you knew what the back-end revenue, if you knew that this goes into billions,
yeah.
it's chump change. And this business is one that there are no guarantees. If you go to law school, you'll be a lawyer. If you go to med school, you'll be a doctor, and you're going to make an income. Some are better than others, of course. You are an actor, or you study acting, or you have ability. You're never guaranteed that you will ever, ever get a job. Think of all the talent that's sitting there that will never be seen or heard. So if you do hit it, if you do luck into a Three's Company, it's your golden moment and to make the most of. And I had never had any money in my life, and I felt very deserving of it, that
yeah.
I sold as many tickets as any of those men that were getting paid those enormous salaries.
So. Sure, sure. Now, I know you said you didn't really speak to anybody for so many years now, and I know you had Joyce DeWitt on your show a couple of years ago on YouTube, and I remember when it came out, and I remember where I saw it on social media, where I saw it, that it was happening, and I remember watching it that day. It was such a sense of urgency to see the two of you together, and I'm looking at it on YouTube now, 1.1 million views.
Mm-hmm.
That must have been pretty emotional.
Yes, and, you know, I would like to take credit for doing something that extraordinary, but we were doing this, my Breaking Through series, which was a 7-minute daily show, as determined by the interest on the Internet. No one will watch anything longer than 7 minutes these days.
Yeah, fair enough.
On the Internet. And one of my young producers in New York came up to me and nervously said, "I took the liberty to call Joyce DeWitt to see if she wanted to come on your show, and she's amenable to it if you'll talk to her first." And I said, I got mad at her. I said, "Who gave you the authority? I've never talked to her. We don't talk to each other." So I go back to my hotel room that night. I'm lying in bed in the dark, and I thought, how stupid, Suzanne. How small. How unevolved, Suzanne. And I went in the next day, and I said, forgive me for my knee-jerk reaction. You are so right. What a brilliant idea. She said, well, the only caveat that Joyce has is that she'd like to talk to you first. And I said, absolutely. So I called Joyce the night before, and she said, I just want to make sure you don't ambush me. And I said, oh, my, you don't, it's been years, and so I would never do that. I would not have done that even then either. I said, I think this will provide closure for you, for me, for those who cared about that show.
Yeah.
I said, I have one thing I want to ask you. And she said, yeah. I said, I would like to not see you before the show. I would like the moment that we see each other for the first time in 30 years to be the moment that is on the air.
Oh, you could tell.
Agreed to that.
You could tell, yeah.
When she came out, that was, and it was genuine. My heart just flooded with feelings at that moment of these two women shared a moment in time like no one else ever will again. There will never be that kind of narrow focus on one particular program because we have such diversity now and the internet, which didn't even exist then.
Right.
And weren't we lucky? And that's what I really wanted to just provide closure and gratitude and you know, remember the good things.
Well, it just tells you the power of the show and the role it played in the world of pop culture and television history.
And the power of forgiveness.
Absolutely.
You know, it's a gift to give yourself. And I was like, I have very few things in my life that I've hung on to. I've pretty much worked through everything. That was one of those things hanging out there. And now that's okay, too. And I'd had the opportunity to talk to John 1 month before he died. 30 years had gone by. And I'm having my hair, I'm in the shampoo bowl at a beauty salon, and the receptionist comes up and says, you have a phone call. And I said, can you take a message? I'll call back. She said, it's John Ritter. And I sat up with my wet hair, and I went into this little back room, and there was John. And he said, look, I forgive you, which I had to deal with that a little bit.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Of,
right.
Oh, well, okay,
yeah.
All right. And it was just a bit of a, wow, we're coming from two different places.
Right,
but I said,
right.
I went past that, and I said, I can't even tell you what it means to me to talk to you. And he said, look, I'm doing a show called 8 Simple Rules, and the writers have written this dream sequence that in my dream, Janet and Chrissy are in the dream. And I said, you know, people have wanted to see a reunion for so long. I just feel there's a better way to do it. And I said, I have wanted to work with you ever since I left that show. There was something about you and I that was magic. I don't know if it's a continuation of these two characters or it's two that are like it or something completely different, but we have magic together. And if you won't take this the wrong way, now that we've rekindled, let's look for that project. And we both agreed, let's look for that project. And then a month later, he was gone.
Good Sunday morning to you once again. It's Dave Plyer right here on 720 WGN. And as we conclude our celebration of television in the far-out 70s, we look back at my conversation with Gavin McLeod, who for 10 seasons was the commanding, competent captain of the Love Boat, and even earlier in the decade played the reliable, witty Murray Slaughter on the Mary Tyler Moore Show.
Exciting and new. Hi, Dave. It's great to be with you.
Well, thank you for being here, Gavin. Now, you start on two of the biggest shows of the 1970s. Let's start with the Mary Tyler Moore Show. How did you get the part of Murray?
Well, I had just come home. I was in Yugoslavia doing Kelly's Heroes, which is a very popular film with a lot of guys.
So Don Rickles again, and Telly Savalas.
And I played with Donald Sutherland, basically, in the tanks. So I just returned from that wonderful run, and we were rehearsing Carousel. I was doing Jigger in Carousel, and my agent calls and said, Mary Tyler Moore is doing a pilot, and they want to see you. I said, oh, great, I love her. And he said, so I'll have them send you the scripts. I said, terrific, Alex. So they sent me two scripts, the pilot and then Rhoda's mother.
Mm-hmm.
So I read them both, and they really knocked me out. I said, this writing is something else. And then it had on the cover of the first page, Gavin, the part of Lou Grant.
Right, right, right.
And so I started reading it with Lou Grant in mind, and I, no, I wouldn't believe myself in that. No, I don't.
You knew
it. I wouldn't believe myself. Nobody else would.
Yeah.
I wouldn't believe myself as Ted Baxter. But this little guy, Murray, you know, I think maybe I can do something with him. Even though he's not the biggest part, he's the third guy. That didn't bother me. I just thought I could really do something with this character. And so I went in to see the producers, Ethel Winant, the first female vice president of a big network. And she really fought to get that show on, by the way. And I did all the Lou Grant readings, and we had a wonderful time. And I had my hand on the door, and I said, you know, you guys, I really like the part of Murray Slaughter. You do? Because I was doing guest star big roles, and they didn't think about me for that. I said, yeah, I think I. And Jim said, can you read? I said, sure, let's read. So I read for it, and I got some laughs, and I said, well, good luck with the show, you know. And then I went out, and I ran into Ed Asner. He was pacing back and forth. I went to rehearsal, and about 3 hours later, my agent comes over, and he waves to me, and so we had a break. I said, what's up, Alex? And he said, they want you to do the Mary Tyler Moore pilot. I said, oh, wow, is that fabulous? What part? He said, I don't know, is there a guy named Murray in that?
Oh, that's great.
I said, there sure is, and that was the beginning of that.
Wow. And did you, now, first of all, you keep running into all these bald guys, obviously, that you're doing business with throughout the years between Wrinkles and everybody. How did Ted get on the show now? Was that a recommendation
Ted
by
was
yourself?
Was the last one cast.
Yeah.
Ted Baxter was supposed to be a young guy.
Okay.
And they saw all these handsome young guys. Like, there was a series called He and She years ago. Jay Sandwich directed that. And Jack Cassidy was in that. And he played an egocentric kind of guy. And so they wanted the same thing with Ted Baxter. And they had seen all these young guys. A lot of them came back and did our show in different roles. But then Ted came in. He was the oldest of them all. And he read, and they had him come back. And he said the second time he went back, he saw this blue blazer. And he said he went and bought this blue blazer, wore this blue blazer into the reading, and he got the job.
Wow, and the rest is history.
He was the last one cast. He was absolutely, you know, he was so brilliant in that role.
Well, what I mean, but with everybody you worked with Mary and even throw in Betty White, I mean, what an incredible experience. That,
and Valerie.
That, absolutely.
And Georgia.
Yeah, yeah, and Cloris.
And Gloris,
yeah,
come on.
Yeah, yeah. Did you know at the time, I mean, at any point during this show, you know, how important the show would become in the history of television?
I don't think so. I don't think anybody did. We were just happy to get on the air. I remember we shot the pilot, and then CBS wanted us to redo some things. They were concerned about, in their conservatism, about Rhoda and being Jewish. And we couldn't understand it.
Yeah.
And they had to make certain changes. Then we shot it again during the middle of the next week. And then we always worked around this big table like they did on the Dick Van Dyke Show. And days after that, the phone rings, and Mary goes, and it turns out to be Bob Wood, the head of CBS. And she's talking and talking and talking. She hangs up, and she turns around to all of us sitting there around the table with our scripts. She said, well, kids, you can send out the laundry. They picked us up for a year. And that's how we heard that we were picked up.
Oh, that's great.
And you know that theme song says, love is all around. It really was.
For most of your career in the movies and in television, you spent a lot of time, you know, either in the military or on the ocean, or both, you know, with Operation Petticoat and McHale's Navy and Ensign Pulver and the Sand Pebbles, the Rat Patrol, Hogan's Heroes, Kelly's Heroes. You were finally promoted to captain on the Love Boat in 1977. So the Love Boat was on the air for 10 seasons. You've got to have so many memories to even mention. You had hundreds of guest stars, big names in Hollywood. Share some of your favorite memories about that show.
Well, you know, we actually were on nine years and 2 weeks.
Okay, is that what it was?
And there were so many guest stars. You know, if this book really sells, I said, we've got to do another one with all the stories about some of the other stars, and we'll call it This Is Your Captain Still Speaking.
Well, I mean, there's so many of them.
But it's true. I had to be so selective on who I was going to write about, because after I finished, I would wake up in the middle of the night thinking, oh, why didn't I put that in the book? Why didn't I put, there were so many different stories. But no, the Love Boat, the reason that I was so proud and everything of the Love Boat is, was like Murray got a promotion. Because all of Murray's fans really, like Aaron, when they first saw the pilot, Aaron said they pushed those buttons, they went crazy when they saw you come on as the captain.
That's cool.
And that was fabulous. And so that worked very well for me. And so all the critics hated it. They called this mindless television, sick like the Titanic, and all these things. But eventually we were in 90 countries. We all became goodwill ambassadors for the United States. And we gave birth to a new cruise industry, really a new cruise industry.
You really did.
And I've been working for Princess Cruises ever since 86, ever since the show went off the air.
That's a big change, though, from going, you know, when the show that you were on previously with Mary Tyler Moore was so focused on the central cast. And then, you know, you were kind of the ringmaster, not only for the, you know, Ted Lang and everybody else who was on the show, but then you also had the opportunity to work with, I mean, just hundreds and hundreds.
Oh, yeah, boy. You got it, Dave. You sound enthusiastic as I am.
It was fun watching.
It was, what a gift it was. You know, when I grew up, for instance, 1 week we had on Joan Fontaine, and she was great with Richard Basehart. She did Rebecca and all these things. Well, it was reputed that she and her sister Olivia de Havilland hadn't spoken to each other in 7 or 8 years, even more. And so 2 weeks later, we get Olivia de Havilland to come in. They bring her over from France.
How great is that?
And we're playing with her. And Olivia de Havilland, my grandmother, took me to see her in a movie called To Each His Own years and years and years ago. And here I am holding this incredible actress in my arms, thinking, if my grandmother could see me now. And I tell you, it wasn't a week went by that I didn't hold. I'd held Mary Martin in my arms. I fell in love with her when I was 16, when I saw her in South Pacific in New York. I'm holding her in my arms. I said, can I tell you something? She said, yeah. I said, I've been in love with you since I was 16 years old.
That's awesome.
But
and
she
you get
did
to tell
Nellie Furbush. Oh, she was so incandescent on the stage. And then there was Ethel Merman. And I met Ethel when she and Ernie got engaged.
Wow.
Way before Mikhail's Navy time. And then she and this is one of my favorite shows. We did the Love Boat Follies with Ethel Merman, Carol Channing, Ann Miller, Della Reese,
wow,
Cab Calloway, and Van Johnson.
Oh, man.
I was in actor's heaven.
Oh, yeah, it was Hollywood's greats. Oh, my
gosh. The only thing is that critic from the L.A. Times still hated us, and he reviewed that show. He knocked them, and I said, I can't believe this guy. And then he finished the entire review by saying, and then when Gavin McLeod is the captain, finished his number, they should have torpedoed the ship.
Oh, man. Merciless. Merciless. But I got to tell you, Gavin, that was appointment viewing at that time. I just remember, you know, when I was a kid, and I was a kid when it was on, I was like 10 or 12 years old. But, yeah, you know, you had to have your teeth brushed, your pajamas on. You had to, you know, take your bath, take your shower, whatever it was. And you were in front of that TV. Mom was making popcorn, and at 8 o'clock,
yes,
you had to be sitting in front of that TV for the Love Boat.
Oh, wow. It was so wonderful to be a part of that, you know. You get jobs, and you get jobs as an actor, but that was really, really very, very special. And we just had a reunion on a talk show the other day at CBS out here, and we hadn't seen each other for some years, and it was so nice to be able to hug each other and just love on each other, you know?
Yeah, you can catch that on YouTube if you want to see that. Now, didn't your wife, Patty, do an episode of The Love Boat?
She did 6 of them.
Oh, really?
I'll tell you what happened was, Lauren Tweez, who played Julie McCoy, was getting married in real life. And so we went to the wedding, and we sat in back of Aaron Spelling and Candy. And he turned around and he said, Patty, I've got a great part for you next week. Well, we were floored because I hadn't pushed for anything like that.
Sure.
And I think it was the second season, the first season, and she was playing opposite Jim Backus. I mean, Jim Backus, right, that played James Dean's father in, you know, that great movie that he did.
And
Rebel Without a Cause. Sure. And then he did Gilligan's Island, and he was the voice of Mr. Magoo. And Jim Magoo. Backus was a pro's pro. Yeah. Patty held her own. Held her own. She was wonderful. And then she did five more. She was in Australia with me. There's a picture of her playing a character with a big red wig on and the captain in the book. Yes, and so that was a blessing too. Yeah.
Well, and you said earlier, you know, life wasn't always perfect, and whose is, by the way? You know,
yeah.
you lost your dad when you were at the young age of 13. You mentioned that you struggled, you know, with alcoholism, and that's kind of how you did some of your own therapy through that, and it affected your marriage. And and you and Patty, you got divorced, but then you got remarried, and there's a reconciliation, obviously, that took place. What kind of brought that all together, and what happened there?
Well, what happened was God works in mysterious ways. In that three-year period, she didn't want the divorce. I did. I really put my work before her. Because when my part wasn't big, I was traveling all over the country doing press. And this was something, the culmination of a lot of years' work, having that responsibility.
Sure.
Welcoming people on this show that hadn't worked in 25, 30 years, you know, making them feel good. I was dealing with a lot of the different things besides just learning the lines. And I put that before her or anybody else. And I just felt I couldn't handle both. So we got a divorce. And in that three-year period, she didn't want the divorce, and she went to psychiatrists on both coasts because we always had a place in Manhattan. And they all said, you know, the guy doesn't want to be married, so you have to let him go. She says, I don't want to let him go. He's my husband. And so finally, after that period of almost 3 years, she runs into Pat Boone and Shirley. And they talk her about God, about what God can do for you if you turn your life over. And so she eventually became a born-again Christian, which means she recognizes Jesus as the Son of God. And so something happened. My mother developed a cyst the size of a baseball inside her left brain, and they were going to operate. And they couldn't tell us if she was going to live or be a vegetable or what, because she was in her mid-70s. And the morning of that operation, I'm living in Beverly Hills thinking the bigger the house, the happier you're going to be. I was all alone, kind of a sad scene.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But what happened, I woke up at 7 o'clock, and I started to pray to Jesus. And I said, if you give my mom more time in this life, I'll turn my life over to you. I don't care if I act. My mother had been a widow since she was 39 years old and never got married. And here she is in her mid-70s. I mean, I bought a condo for her and things like that, but it's not the same. And so that's what I did. I just prayed to Jesus. And as soon as I said that, something told me to call Julie, my secretary, so I could get Patty's number to call her. I don't know why I'm doing this, but something's guiding me. I got the number. Julie said, you sure you want to do this, boss? I said, oh, yeah, I sure do. I don't know why, but I want to talk to her. So I called her at 7:15, and she said, hello. I said, hi, this is Gavin. She says, I was just thinking about you. I said, can we be friends? And she said, that's all I've ever wanted.
Wow.
I don't know why I'm even saying this. And then I said, can I see you? She said, well, that would be wonderful, except I have to go away. I'm on the road. I belong to a group called Ladies, L-A-D-I-E-S. I said, what does that stand for? And she said, life after divorce can eventually be sane. It's full of all of us who have been dumped by you guys.
Yeah.
I said, oh. I said, so when can I see you? And she said, what about Monday? So the following Monday, I went down there, and I knocked, and there was no answer. I knocked again, there was no answer. I said, uh-oh. She's standing me up. I don't blame her. I was a rat. I tried it one more time, and then the door opens. She's there, 5 foot tall. We hug and hug and hug. And she says, I'm sorry, Gavin, your dinner's cold. It's been waiting for 3 years.
Oh, what a great line.
And then she goes in, and she says, I have this for you. And she brought out a Bible with my name on it. She said, look, I put on my ring again. And I have set a place for you, waiting for you to come home. And every time I come in here, I say, hi, honey, I'm home. And we just talked and talked. She explained to me what born again meant. I said, that's what I want. She put on television and I could see some evangelists there. I said, Patty, that's what I want. That's exactly what I want. And so before you know it, Pat and Shirley Boone and Patty brought me to church on the way, a wonderful church in the San Fernando Valley, Pastor Jack Hayford. And I gave my life to Christ. We got baptized in the water. And my life hasn't been the same since.
What I mean, first of all, what an incredible journey through all this. And what an inspirational story. I told you this before we started the interview. It's just to hear those moments in your life, and they really happened throughout your life that opened your eyes and brought you back to your lovely wife as well.
I know. When a door closes, like the first story I have in the book when I got fired, when a door closes, another one will open. Maybe two will open. Maybe a window will open. But something will open. And keep your eyes on God. He's the father of us all. A lot of us, because I lost my father when I was a young boy, and I never had an older man to relate to. I had no one to go to. And then eventually I realized that he's my real father. God has been there all the time, letting me go through all these mistakes so I could finally be where I am today. And that's why I'm so grateful. The joy of the Lord is my strength. You know, I've had operations on my heart and my back and my legs and everything, but boy, I'm alive, I'm kicking, and I'm enjoying every moment of it.
Gavin, thanks so much for spending some time with us tonight.
David, this has been a very special interview, and that's because you're a very special guy, and you really live up to your name, which means beloved.